We are coming up on MLB Hall of Fame weekend in Cooperstown, and at ESPN.com, Buster Olney worked with Alex Rodriguez on a piece about the upcoming Hall of Fame class, and especially Mariano Rivera. A-Rod talked about the impact that he had. He said that, first of all, he quoted George Steinbrenner a lot, and he said, in our clubhouse, it was like he was the embodiment of what Steinbrenner demanded from the Yankees. In comportment and style, he remembered everything he learned from George and Don Mattingly, and he had so much Yankee pride. He was always perfectly shaved. I can't remember seeing a 5 o'clock shadow on him ever. And on every road trip, his tie was knotted tightly, perfectly, like he was a drill sergeant. And when you join a culture and you grow up within a culture, that's what you're going to do. And that's what you're going to espouse to youngsters. And I always got that impression of Mariano Rivera, that he was just the consummate professional, and that it's kind of like you perform how you dress, and he was one of those guys. His uniform was always perfect, too.
I think that stuff like that's important. It's important to, first of all, when you come in, I always believe in doing things the right way. And whatever the letter of the law is, whatever the rules are, that's what you do. But then you become those things. Like, so young kids come up and they see you. And as A-Rod said there, he sees him and the way that he goes about him and the accountability that is there. That's winning organizations to me. Now, I think that those aspects are going to get a little bit tougher and tougher as we go on, mainly because there are only a handful of guys around baseball that are going to hang on with an organization long enough to have that type of an influence. And maybe all of those guys don't have those same characteristics where they want to hold everybody to that higher standard or even like have that personality trait where they can do something like that. I think that's going to be different, but I believe it to be special. And I do also think it's interesting having it be done by the closer.
Yes.
Well, he's not the only one, but it's kind of a random one to hold everybody in line. But it also makes perfect sense when you look at it in the aspect of who's watching the most baseball. It's him. Like, his job every single day depends on if you have the lead or not. And his first five innings are likely in the clubhouse watching the game, doing his preparation, getting ready. So he has a pulse on a little bit of everything. And then when you play the game to the level that Mariano did, well, you speak, people listen. I think it's kind of funny, and it makes sense in the same way.
I think it's the kind of thing that you have to build that reputation over time. You can't just come right in and be that guy who's doing that. And it's an important idea that you mentioned about him being a closer. You wouldn't think of all team leaders that it would be somebody who, not that he doesn't pitch every day, because he pitches a lot of days, especially if the team is good, because he's coming in to close out those wins, but he's not an everyday player where he's in the lineup and he hits four or five times a game and he's in the field for eight or nine innings. You don't really see that coming from a closer or coming from a reliever, and a lot of times you don't see it coming from a pitcher. And maybe from the Cardinals' perspective, they've had a little bit of a different situation because they've had guys who were like that, who were starting pitchers in their history, in their recent history, but it's kind of unusual to happen that way.
And while what Rivera was off the field and from a culture standpoint is admirable, I don't think that it should be glossed over that when they didn't win from 2003 until 2009, after the 2008 season, they were looked upon as a briefcase team, a Wall Street Journal team, a team that came into the office. They were completely businesslike, and maybe for a baseball team, over businesslike. And they went out and got Nick Swisher, kind of a goofball. They went out and got a personality pitcher like CC Sabathia, and then they won again in 09. Well, I think it's great to have that absolute professionalism that people like Rivera and Jeter brought to the table. I think because it's a game, you also have to have those people that are having fun doing it too.
You better have balance. You better have balance within a clubhouse. And if you have a manager that's far one side, you better make sure you have a leader on your team that maybe is a little bit on the other side, because when you have a roster of 25 grown men, not everybody's going to be the same. Not everybody's going to think the same. You might all have the same goal, which is perfect. Your goal as a team should be to win, to get to the playoffs, to win a championship, but you're not all going to get there the same way. So you're right. It takes a lot of different types of leadership, but you have to have somebody, or at least a few somebodies, hopefully, that there's the accountability factor. And the accountability doesn't always have to be like Mariano Rivera, as A-Rod goes on in this piece to say, calls him out it and say, hey, you idiot, what are you swinging at? Like, what are you doing? It doesn't always have to be that. The accountability could also be, I know you just saw what I did. I know that you just saw me run for an hour and lift weights and all this stuff, and you have the same job that I do. So where are you at? What are you going to do? There's different ways to do it, but it's important nonetheless. However you get your point across, it's important that it happens.
When I read that part from A-Rod talking about him coming back in, and he would say through innings, from innings one through five, Rivera, part of his routine would be that he would be in the clubhouse and then he would make his way out to the bullpen. But if he would come back in when the team was batting and Rodriguez had come back into the clubhouse to do whatever and he would see Mo in there, he would call him out and he would say, what are you swinging at that pitch for? And I thought what was interesting about it is how often do you hear a pitcher or a reliever or a closer tell a hitter to his face that kind of criticism? I don't think you ever see something like that.
A couple of things about Rivera. Number one, when he became the Yankees closer in 97, Joe Torre brought him into his office. He converted, I think, three of his first six save opportunities. And Torre brought him into his office and said, look, you are our closer. We got rid of John Wetland. You're the guy, and I'm going to keep putting you back out there. And then Rivera reeled off something like 19 in a row and became Mariano Rivera. But my favorite thing about him, and BT, I think you'll appreciate this from a pitcher's standpoint, he would never give a hitter that beat him credit. He would never say he hit a good pitch. He would never say he beat me. Whenever he didn't win, it was because of what he didn't do right. If he was on his game, he was going to dominate the opposition. He was never going to give credit to them. It was always, he wasn't on his game. He did something wrong when he didn't win.
Well, that's always a funny one when you're in a scrum and a reporter will say, that was a good pitch, you know, right? And he just hit it. He's like, obviously not. Well, it wasn't a good pitch. Did he hit it out of the ballpark? No, it wasn't a freaking good pitch. I got to make better pitches. I got to do better. And while maybe Mo knew sometimes in his heart of hearts that that was exactly where I wanted to put that, and he got the jump on the cutter, which nobody ever gets, I like not bending ever.
Me too.
Because you know what? That's something that the hitter in the back of his head is probably thinking about. It's like, this son of a – like. He didn't even say, give me nothing.
No, maybe he really does own me.
Yes, and he's just going to get in your kitchen next time when you know the cutter is coming. And I don't think that there's anybody else like that. I don't think there's not. There's not one pitch like that right now where everybody knows it's coming and he still dominates you with it. There's outlandish stuff in the big leagues right now. There's 100 miles an hour fastballs with sink. There's wipeout sliders. There's good cutters, good changeups. Nothing like what Mo brought to the table for two decades.
My most shocking World Series Game 7 moment is that Luis Gonzalez got that hit off of him to beat him in 2001.
Got lucky.
Yeah, he did.
What would be the closest pitch right now? Who's got the closest pitch that you know is coming every single time? And you still can't do anything with it.
For a while, it was Jansen. Jansen was close with that cutter, but not anymore.
I don't know how you do that.
Yeah,
it's pretty remarkable.
There's some nasty ones. Chris Sale's got a silly slider where you just, when he's on, you're like, okay, have fun with that.
That must also though be deceiving because you don't know it's that until the last minute. It's not like the Rivera cutter where you know that's all he's going to throw you.
But the crazy thing about the cutter is coming into you, and even thinking about this as a lefty, it still looks like the four-seam fastball. It's like, oh, crap, he's going to dot this on the inner half, and then whack, you're holding a handle, and he's laughing at you, basically. that's the beauty of a nasty pitch is that it looks like something else all the time. So even if you don't mix it up. And by the way, he had a filthy sinker, too, that he would use like once every 20 games. All of a sudden, when somebody's geared up for a cutter, he throws a sinker. It's like, oh, okay. Real nice. Real nice, Mo.
Although anybody was able to ever count how many bats he broke.
I was just about to ask that question.
Didn't somebody make him a chair out of bats?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think somebody did, right? And broken bats, I think.
Yeah, when he on his retirement tour. Yeah.
It might have been in Chicago. It might have been with the White Sox. They've got a guy, Ron Kittle, who used to play for them. He played for, I think, Philadelphia for a while. Big dude. He just hit a lot of home runs.
Rookie of the year in 83,
yes,
right?
Yes, Rookie of the Year. Very good, Randy.
It was the Twins.
Okay, because he makes furniture out of baseball bats and bases and that sort of thing. I know they gave him something. I just can't remember what. But Yeah, look at that.
That's fantastic.
That is a really cool thing to do for him.
Here's all of our lumber.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The New York Times tallied him with 44 broken bats and 80 2/3 innings in 2001.
One every other inning.
Those ones are always a good time for a pitcher. And early on in my career, when nobody knew I was throwing a sinker every single pitch, I would get some on right-handers. I love $100 at-bats, especially in the minor leagues where the guys, not everybody's getting their lumber for free, where you see them just angry, and then you shatter two in an at-bat. It's like, got them.
So how does that work? They have to just buy their own bats?
Yeah, a lot of guys
do,
man.
The team doesn't do anything for them?
You'll get some pro stock here and there, but once you run through those, you're kind of SOL.
Wow.
So guys have to pony up.
That sucks.
Yes, it does. Don't swing at the sinker in, then, or the cutter.
It's the Fast Lane, 101 ESPN. Coming up, the Cardinals are in a buy or sell conundrum, but hey, at least they aren't alone. That's next on 101 ESPN. The Cardinals open a four-game series in Cincinnati tonight, and with roughly 70 games left for each of the teams in the National League, only the Marlins are more than five games out of a playoff spot. If a team like the Reds, even a team like the Giants, would want to make a move to bolster themselves, I wouldn't begrudge them. I wouldn't think it was the smartest thing in the world to do, but especially if you have a history like the Giants and you aren't drawing like you used to, or if you haven't been to the playoffs in forever like the Reds and you want to just make the playoffs, why not be a buyer? I think there is a real dichotomy between the teams at the top that you think are going to be buyers and the teams that are at the bottom that are you perceive are going to be sellers. It's clearly a seller's market here because so many teams in both leagues are in playoff contention.
Five games separate everybody in the National League with the exception of the Marlins from a playoff spot right now. So certainly that's complicating everything, but there have to be some teams within that five-game mix that know what they are, or better yet, know what they're not.
You would think so. Randy, I have an answer to your question. Mm-hmm. While it's not a good answer, it's one nonetheless of, why wouldn't you buy? Why wouldn't you add? The answer is because you'd be screwing it up for the teams that can actually win. That's where those other pieces come from. Now, there are teams that do both. It's like, all right, take this piece, and we're going to add this piece, and we're going to do a lot of different things, and you are able to do that. But it is difficult, and it's harder and harder for different franchises, and I wonder if it's actually a more difficult thing for a team like Cincinnati, who finds themselves like close enough, and they're starving. Their fan base, while they struggle actually to get a ton of fans there, it's been better and better here recently. Like, they need a push badly. But it makes no sense. You've got seven free agents that are about to walk out the door. Only one of them with an option on them. That's Jared Hughes that you have. It makes sense to trade off pieces. It makes sense to trade off maybe tonight's starter, Tanner Roark. He ends up going to a contender, whoever it is. But with that, that makes more sense to me than a team like the Giants, who actually have that winning pedigree, where they look at it, because they're not as starved as Cincinnati is.
But the problem the Giants have is that they have virtually nobody in their system, because they've traded all those guys for all that winning up until a couple of years ago. They've got three class high A minor league players. They have not a single major league ready good minor league player.
Well, that's why it makes sense to make trades, right? Yeah, trade off Bumgarner, right. Trade off Will Smith.
And the only way they can really buy is by, like you were talking about, do both. Trade Bumgarner and or Smith for players that you can put on your roster right now.
Yeah, and I would think the Giants would look at themselves, even though they've operated in the last couple of off seasons like they were trying to win. Remember a couple of off seasons ago when they did all they did, and I remember thinking, why? Why does this team think it has an opportunity? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they finished far out of first place.
They became emotionally attached to the guys that won for them.
Which is maybe different, and I'm glad BT brought up the Reds, because I am really curious to know how desperate are they to just get in. Is it? I would think at this point, considering the fact that it's been so long for them, that they've been in the playoffs, then maybe just getting to a wild card game they would consider some kind of victory for themselves, and the fan base would be happy about just getting that one game playoff.
And if they get closer, they're 7 games under .500 right now, right? But that, I guess that doesn't matter when the division is as close as it is. Now, the Cardinals could ruin all chances for them. They can go rattle off 4 straight, and then all of a sudden Cincinnati says, well, know where we're at, know what we're going to do as the trade deadline approaches. But if it goes the other way, I agree, because I do think that that would be a victory for a team like that. While you're not going to send off your high end, your biggest prospects, you might do a little tinkering just so you can get your foot in the door that appeases fans.
I look at two teams that would benefit most from buying. In the American League, it's the Yankees, because they need another starting pitcher with the injury to Severino, and you don't know what CC is going to be at the end of the season. Hap has been touch or go from a health standpoint. They need another horse in their rotation. And then the other one is Atlanta. They already added Keuchel. They needed a veteran starting pitcher. If they would be the team that would go out and get a Matthew Boyd and a Shane Green, or if they would be the team that would go get a Bumgarner and a Will Smith, if they could add themselves a closer and another veteran front of the rotation starter, then the Dodgers have a concern.
They do. I think there are a few teams, too, that would go out, and if they made a big-time move like that and sacrifice their farm system, if they didn't win a World Series, it would be a bust.
Yes.
The Yankees find themselves in a situation like that, because it's been a World Series or bust for them this
year.
Pretty much every single year. Anyways, the Dodgers are the same way. If the Dodgers went out and made that big-time trade, they fall short yet again. It's a bust. I don't think I consider the Braves to be in that situation, because the Braves have so much young talent and controlled talent for the foreseeable future. There are some organizations that can take more risks than other ones can.
I wonder what the Cardinals think. We all know what we think of the Cardinals, but this is an organization that said 4 straight years of missing the playoffs would be completely unacceptable. And they went out and got Goldschmidt. They went out and made the Miller trade. But they need stuff right now, and they have a system, and they have some, as Bill DeWitt calls it, dry powder, because that money that they were going to spend on Giancarlo Stanton last year, they spent $130 million of it on Goldschmidt, but he was going to get $250 from the Cardinals.
It's a little bit different.
Yeah, so they've still got some dry powder. I think they do need to be in a buy scenario. That's just hearing what our listeners tell us, what we hear at the ballpark. I think they do need to go for it.
Well, I don't.
And making the playoffs. I'm not saying that they can build a World Series champion.
Right.
I think they need to put themselves in playoff contention.
I think they do too, but I feel like their thought process has been pretty prudent, or at least the way they see themselves is being a prudent franchise, that they're not going to overextend themselves. Even the Goldschmidt acquisition has long-term consequences for them, or at least they felt like they were doing something right for the next several years, and not something that's just going to get them into the playoffs for this season. They've not really ever been that aggressive, not in a long time. And I don't, since maybe 2011, but that team was good. I mean, that was a really, really good team. I don't know if they see themselves that way this year. And I don't think, based on the way they've operated the last three, I don't see them going that direction all of a sudden.
At the very least, you always have parameters. And one for me is, and there's always outliers to every deal, but I'm not going to make a deal to hopefully cling to the playoffs and then watch Nolan Gorman stick it up my you-know-what in the upcoming years, because I got a little bit desperate. Even though the fan base is desperate, even though the organization is desperate to make the postseason, I can't get away from my plan. I actually like the idea that you're talking about there with the dry powder, because the type of deals that really make sense to me for the Cardinals, and this is all barring, you know, no trades and stuff, but it's like a guy like Greinke, where you look at him.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
He's got so much money left on him. There's not that many teams that can go out there and say, all right, well, we'll do that. We'll pony up that type of cash to keep Zach Greinke around, or to get him within the organization. The Cardinals have that flexibility, and then it doesn't cost you as much on the prospect side. Stuff like that makes sense to me.
They have the flexibility if they want to do it, but also you have to look at yourself as a team that, and I don't see them as a team that's a World Series contender right now. And I don't know. Yeah, I mean, they can get to the playoffs, but I don't like their chances.
Not a realistic one.
Correct. And anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know, anything can happen once you get there, but is the team set up in such a way that their bullpen looks like they're going to blow through everybody in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings once you've you know, once you get deep into a game? Do they look like a team that's going to put up a bunch of runs? I mean, maybe, but not really. There's so many what-ifs with them. I don't know if I'm willing to get entirely aggressive with this team because I don't know if they're a World Series contender, and I don't know if one move makes them that.
So we get a text here, Hot Shots text line from the 314. He says, my attention and investment in the Cardinals will substantially decrease next year if they don't make the playoffs this year. Now, that is that's not just one person thinking. Nope. That's one text.
Right.
But there are probably a lot of people thinking that way. So as an organization, how do you weigh that?
Right. And you have to look at the stands. I mean, this is reality. This is not people threatening. This is already happening.
Yeah, I know they're concerned with the amount of tickets that have gone unused. And that's been for the last couple of years. But the question to somebody like that who's texting in, and I think they have a real, that's a legitimate feeling to have from a fan right now because of what they have not done the last few years. But is making a wild card game going to make you feel better about buying tickets next year? Is just getting to a division series, is that going to do it for you? That's the question I have for people who say they either make the playoffs now or I'm out for next year.
It's like, but what
does
if
that
they
mean
screw
just
the next
appearance?
Three over, you know?
And right. I think it depends on what you add. If the reason that you get to a wild card or the playoffs is because Zach Greinke was great down the stretch, that makes you feel a lot better about the situation.
Well, and he's controlled, too.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a big thing when you're looking at it. I don't know.
And you have him for the draft next year, too.
All right. He's pretty much a draft Nick. You know, the thing that you're talking about there, Ronj, though, like the way that you look at it, what are you happy with, what are you not? Randy, we were having a similar conversation in the office yesterday, but it was about football, and it was about paying Peyton Manning for Monday Night Football. Monday Night Football makes a ton of money anyhow,
mm-hmm.
and they're probably maxed out. Like that's what they're going to do. So what does it matter if you pay Peyton $10 million when you can pay somebody else like $3 million? Like is there a net benefit?
Nobody's going to not watch Monday Night Football because of the whoever's there.
Yeah, it's more of a financial conversation, but at what point does it make sense?
People hated Fouts and Miller. And they still watched.
Right. And the
so
thing
it's not
with,
like it's going to, that's, I agree with that.
You have a captive audience. Are the people that you draw because of Peyton Manning going to be worth more than $10 million a year? Everything's going to come down to cost analysis, right? Cost benefit analysis.
Yeah.
There's no way that Peyton Manning is going to add enough people to the Monday Night Football viewing audience to be worth $10 million.
Yeah, and that's and the reason I just went that direction with it was talking about acquiring talent. Like, mm-hmm. so is you bringing in a guy and making a trade and making a wild card game and maybe booting it, is that going to be enough financially for an organization to say, all right, well, I'm going to sacrifice quite a bit to get to this point?
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into making these decisions.
See, and for me, I think the opportunity was lost in the offseason. If you really wanted to make this team more on an even level with the Cubs or closer to the Dodgers, they wouldn't have caught up with the Dodgers. But they could have gotten closer to what Los Angeles is if they get really uncomfortable and spend a little bit more. You had Dallas Keuchel available. You had Machado and Harper available. I know you got Goldschmidt, but the goal is to not get a good hitter. The goal is to catch up with all those other teams that are really good in the National League, and they missed an opportunity in the offseason, and I kind of feel like right now it's a little bit too late to make up for it.
The Cardinals are in Cincinnati tonight, and Tiger Woods shot a 78 in his first round at the British Open.
Is that bad?
Pretty bad. Coming your way next in your Hot Topics of the Day on 101 ESPN. One of our favorites, Dakota Hudson, goes for the Cardinals tonight in the opener of a four-game series at the So-So American Ballpark against the Reds. Cincinnati is going to go with Tanner Roark, who this year has not been, I don't think, exactly what the Reds expected him to be when they got him from Washington. 5-6 with a 3.99. He hasn't been terrible, but he's been more of that back-of-the-rotation guy than a middle-of-the-rotation
guy. You know what, though? That's kind of what they need. They need innings eaters. They need stability. They need somebody to take the ball every fifth day. And I think that there are a lot of teams out there at the trade deadline that might need something like that, where it's just a little bit of stability so Roark's name will get thrown around. Here's what I want, and this is a broader view, not necessarily about this game, but it's more so approaching the trade deadline. Break their will. We just had a whole segment about, huh, what are the Reds going to do? What's this team going to do? Show them what they're going to do. Sell. You're going to sell because you're going to get dominated for four straight games. The Cardinals finally have a tiny bit of momentum. They've won a couple of series in a row. The starting pitching overall has been really good. The bullpen stepped up. Goldie's getting better. Tyler O'Neill is on a tear. Things are going well. Keep them going
so,
well.
Here's the thing. You win four in a row, and as Mo is walking out of the visitor's GM box on Sunday and runs into their GM, he says, "You're done, Dick."
Take that, Dick.
Well, if he did that, I would have a whole lot more respect for him.
Be funny.
Yeah.
Here's the Cardinal lineup for tonight. Tommy Edman at third leading off. Jose Martinez in right hitting second. Paul Goldschmidt is your first baseman and hitting third. Tyler O'Neill, Dexter Fowler, Nat Wieters, DeYoung, Wonger, and Hudson. When do we reach that point where if you're not going to play Harrison Bader every day, and he does play a lot, that if he's not an everyday player for you, that he should be playing at AAA trying to get himself straightened up?
I would think that's got to be soon, because if you really truly believe in him for your future or as part of your future, then he's got to get the reps, right? He can't just be sitting on the bench and playing every so often. That's somebody who's got to be out there every day. Even though the competition isn't going to be as good, maybe he starts to feel even better about himself if he has some success at AAA. If he were to take that assignment the right way, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of young players would, I think they would understand. I believe mm-hmm. he would. He seems to have his stuff together. I don't know, maybe not, but if you get sent back down and they just say, look, it's a matter of time before you're right back up here. Just do your work, get yourself ready, and before you know it, you're a member of this team again. I think he would handle that well.
Yeah, I think that he would be okay, and maybe he'd come up even better for it. Sometimes you got to get, you know, take a step back to take a step forward, and maybe that would be the case for him. The only issue that I have, and it's not about sending him down, it's about who would come up. It would be Randy Arozarena, yeah. most likely, but I think that the same principle is there for Arozarena. Yeah, because I don't want to call a guy up and then just have him sitting on the bench and just hanging out, and then all of a sudden he gets a pinch hit opportunity that doesn't go well against a nasty reliever late in the game, and he doesn't get any momentum. I feel like if you're going to call that guy up, you kind of got to plug and play as well.
Tons of daytime baseball. In the first inning, the Rays lead at Yankee Stadium 2-0. All the other day games are final. The Marlins knocked off the Padres 4-3. Philadelphia beat the Dodgers again 7-6. So Philadelphia had a pretty good run against LA over the course of the week at home. The Red Sox blanked Toronto. Chris Sale with the shutout, a two-hitter, 5-0. Boston over the Blue Jays. And it was Kansas City over the White Sox 6-5. Tonight, as you look at the National League, the Cubs have the night off, and the Brewers will play at Arizona. That game starts at 8:40 St. Louis time.
Let's go D-backs and gain a little ground tonight.
Good idea.
I think so.
It was a crazy day at round one of the British Open. Tiger Woods with a 78, and afterwards he said he just didn't feel good. He tried to mask the physical problems that plagued him during the first round, but apparently just did not move around well and fired a 78 in bad weather.
He didn't get his first birdie until the 15th. I mean, he just wasn't on top of things. Now, he wasn't the only one. There were a lot of prominent golfers. Rory, everybody was hyped up. Mm-hmm. Rory's playing in Ireland. Things are going to go well.
Woof.
Oh.
We got do like quadruple bogey, right?
Eight-piece McNugget. Got a snowman on the first one. That's a little difficult.
Carricker hole, but David Duval had the ultimate Carricker hole. And by the way, he on number five had a quadruple. And then on number seven, he took a 13. 13.
Damn, I've done that.
I have too.
Actually, I haven't. I pick it up. If it's gonna be more than eight, I just take a snowman and call it.
I kind of do
it
real quick. Is that bad?
Yeah. Huh. So he had taken an eight at the fifth hole. At number seven, he hit two tee shots that were bad enough to cause him to hit provisionals. When the first balls were not found, he was already lying five. At that point, Duval hit what turned out to be a ball that wasn't his. Put something like DD on it with a Sharpie. Anyway, he hit the wrong ball and hit several more shots that didn't count. He said, I get up in front of the green, I discover it was the wrong number two Titleist. He said, I'm at fault, I didn't check it myself close enough. It happened to me once before, a marshal is standing right next to the ball, it's just my mistake. After hitting what was his eighth shot, he needed six more shots to get down for a 14 on the hole.
Now, I was always told that when you hit somebody else's ball, you get arrested. That's not true?
It's a different ball.
Yeah.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I am a huge fan of hitting anybody's ball that's in a better lie than my ball. So if I am off in the woods and I know that my ball is probably another 50 yards in there, but I see one, I'm like, oh, look at that. got lucky. Must hit a branch. Yeah. We're good.
Who's going to know?
We are good. Randy, what's your do you have like one golf shot that sticks out to you as like one of the worst golf shots you've ever had? Because I've got one off the top of my mind. It was at like a Muni course when I was in college playing with some of my buddies. The first hole, and directly to the right of it is just like a park bench. Like people would just like walk through there. And there was a gentleman sitting on the bench. I towed it and hit a screamer that hit right off the bench next to him. And I've never had a worse look in my life than from that gentleman.
You almost killed a guy.
I should have been sitting there.
I have hit horrific shots, too many to remember. I'm just really bad. By the way, J.B. Holmes leads. He's alone at 5-under after one round. Shane Lowry at -4. He's alone in second. And then among the group that is in third place, tied at -3, Alexander Norin, Webb Simpson, Sergio Garcia, Dylan Fratelli, Robert McIntyre, and Kiradek Afiborot. Those are the guys that are at -3. Orion Fox and Tyrell Hatton. Oh, boy, there's a lot of at -3. Tommy Fleetwood, Brooks Koepka, Lee Westwood, Tony Finau, John Rahm, a lot of players at -3 and that are absolutely in the hunt.
I might have heard it a little bit wrong, but I was watching as Brooks Koepka teed off on -1, and I think I heard like a smattering of boos in there for
Koepka. He's becoming the villain.
Yeah. If you hate Brooks Koepka, you just hate the life that he's built.
Here's the thing.
Because he's doing his thing.
Well, he was asked at his press conference, why do you play so well in majors and not well in regular tournaments? And he said, well, because I only practice for majors. He said,
holla at your boy. Yeah.
He said, if I'm playing golf, you'll see me on TV. That was his line.
Nice.
That's awesome. Good for him. He's living the good life right
golf
now.
Golf needs more cocky dudes in it. Good for him.
So maybe he'll be that villain. Hey, we've got a mic drop coming up. We're going to talk to Phil Pritchard, the keeper of the Stanley Cup. We want to know what you would do if you had the Stanley Cup for a day. Would you take it to family? Would you take it to the backyard? Maybe barbecue with it? What would you do? And remember, you've got the keeper of the cup with you, so it's got to be reasonable. Although Jordan Binnington, I believe, did sleep with it. But you have to tell us.
Like sleep with it?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know.
No, fell asleep.
Oh.
Snored.
Okay.
It wasn't like a Chris Duncan kind of scenario.
Or an Ovi.
Yeah. So if you had the cup for a day, leave us a mic drop, 101 ESPN with the 101 ESPN app. We want to know what you would do with the cup, and you can tell us here at 101 ESPN. But coming up, Barry Odom and Mizzou appeared earlier this week at SEC Media Days, but the Tigers have seemed to be a hot topic all week long. We'll talk about that with Gabe DeArmond of PowerMizzou.com. He's next on 101 ESPN. It's ESPN's Peter Burns on the Kevin Wheeler Show on 101 ESPN with Brad Thompson and Chris Ranji. I'm Randy Carricker, and we head now to the Brown and Crouppen Celebrity Line. And joining us is Gabe DeArmond of PowerMizzou.com, one of the preeminent Mizzou experts and a friend of the show. Gabe, great to have you with us. How you doing today?
Not bad, guys. What's going on?
No, not too much. We're just getting geared up, getting ready for football. We figured, I mean, you would be the guy to talk to. And you heard that coming in, talking about the excitement around Mizzou. And I try to think about this just from a team standpoint. I would feel like anything that would be against us as a group would bring us together more as a group. As you've been around these guys all spring and the summer now, is that the feeling that you get, that they've actually grown closer through these infractions?
Oh, this has been a unifying thing, not just for Missouri football, but I think really for the whole athletic department and the fans, and I don't want to say the university, that might be overstating it, but as far as the sports teams, yeah, I definitely think this is the first time in a lot of years that it feels like everybody's pulling in the same direction. Now, they have something to pull against, you know, like you said, it generally, like you need something to unite you. It's like a common enemy. And I definitely think that's been the case.
Why was the program so successful in making sure kids didn't flock somewhere else after the infractions happened?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of things. And I think that Barry does deserve credit for the culture he's built. And, you know, these guys genuinely seem to like each other and get along. I also think that's been a little overstated. Because now Kelly Bryant's the one that I initially thought he may go. But then when you really think about it, Kelly Bryant didn't come here to play in a bowl game. I mean, if it was if he wanted to play in a bowl game and win a bowl game, like, he was out of place. He was going to do that. Now, how much he would have played, who knows? But if he just wanted to be in a bowl game, he'd have gone to Clemson. So that really wasn't why Kelly Bryant came here. That was more about the NFL and the next level and everything and getting a chance to start games. But the rest of the guys, I mean, when you talk about guys like Cale Garrett, Jasir Durant, DeMarcus Acey, I mean, these are kids they put in anywhere between 2 and 4 years here. But they've gotten it. They've made their friends, have their relationships, know the coaches. They're going to start here. They're going to play a lot. So, you know, I don't think probably Georgia and Alabama and Clemson were calling on those kids because they have some pretty good players already. So really it comes down to, are you going to go somewhere and start over and do all that, learn a new system, a new coaching staff, new teammates, all that for 1 year for a chance to play in the Gator Bowl? I think we overstated the threat of that at the beginning of this whole thing.
Gabe DeArmond of PowerMizzou.com with us on 101 ESPN. You can follow Gabe on Twitter at Gabe DeArmond. And, of course, you can sign up and be a premium subscriber to PowerMizzou.com. It's great. Gabe, can you give us a timeline of how this appeal is going to play out?
Nope. I mean, you know, it's the NCAA. Who knows? Missouri's appeal is sometime this week. Could be today, could be tomorrow, whatever. We know by the end of tomorrow it's done. So Missouri will make that argument. And then basically what is going to happen is pretty much radio silence. I mean, I don't know. Missouri people might talk about it a little bit when they come back here, but I'd be surprised. Then the NCAA is just going to – the Committee on Appeals is going to make its decision at some point. That could be as soon as 4 weeks. I know Dave Matter tweeted out a couple days ago that last year Ole Miss had a hearing like this on July 18th. Which is, you know, almost a year to the day. And their final decision came down on November 1st. So nobody really knows. It could – I mean, I don't think it's impossible, although I think it's unlikely that, like, it's not done before the football season's over. I think it probably will be, but they just operate on their completely own timeline. And honestly, in a lot of situations, with their completely own facts, opinions and all that. So, no, I can really give you absolutely no idea what to expect going forward.
All right, well, let's get to the on-the-field product a little bit, what we're looking forward to. People are excited about Kelly Bryant, obviously, rightfully so. When you look at the hierarchy of quarterbacks within the SEC, how long does it take you to get to Kelly Bryant?
Well, Tua is clearly number one.
Sure.
I think Jake Fromm is clearly number two. Then after that, you kind of throw into the mix, you know, Kellen Mond at A&M. Kelly Bryant's in that discussion kind of as maybe that third guy. And you know, he did make a college football playoff, and he as a starter, he deserves credit for that. He's done it. He had a heck of a team around him. But he's a good, experienced quarterback. He's, I don't think, going to be the All-SEC quarterback. I don't think he's like a Heisman candidate, but he's a very solid college starting quarterback who has, I think, a pretty good offense around him.
So looking at the SEC this season, I've seen people say they could go 8-4. I've seen 10-2. As you look at them and you look at the schedule and some of the stuff we were talking about earlier in them feeling more like a cohesive unit than they have in a very long time, how can you see this season playing out for them?
Yeah, it is. It's so schedule-driven, guys. I mean, last year, a trip to Alabama is replaced this year by Ole Miss coming to Columbia. Can we agree that's a net positive for Missouri?
Probably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's going your way. So Ole Miss and Arkansas, most people expect to be the two worst teams in the West. Those are the two teams Missouri gets. And then in the East, I've always said this. I would prefer, unless I'm like an elite team, I would prefer to give me my toughest games, the games I'm probably going to be an underdog anyway, give me those on the road. So give me Georgia on the road because you're going to be an underdog to Georgia no matter where you play. I mean, they beat you here by 14 last year, so you're going to be an underdog in that game no matter what. So put that one on the road. But then Missouri really, I think, has five swing games this season. West Virginia, Florida, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky. They play four of those five at home. The only road trip is Kentucky, which is, you know,
probably no better than the third best team on that list. So their two biggest swing games, I think, are at home. Maybe their three biggest swing games are at home. So anything less than 8 would be a disappointment, I think. I mean, 7-5 is not a disaster, but it'll be a disappointment. 8-4, I think, is kind of the lowest where you'd say, yeah, that's solid. It's not great, but it's solid. 9 wins or more, I think everybody should be happy with. I'd probably pick, if I had to do it today, in fact, I did it on our podcast today, I would pick Missouri as 9-3 today. 10-2 wouldn't stun me. 8-4 wouldn't stun me. But I just generally tend to think, you know, those swing games, if they're 5 swing games, like, let's take them 3-2 in those games, and that would put you at 9-3 for the season.
Gabe, the premium content at Power Mizzou is always great, and now you've got a new Power Mizzou newsletter that you send out, too.
We do. It's basically, you know, if you want to sign up for that, it's for the people who, shame on you, do not maybe check the site every day or live on there. I mean, it's mostly just kind of a recap of, hey, here's what we got. Here's links to the stories we've done. We certainly encourage you to just be on there all day, every day, at work, whatever, you know, all the time. But if you're not, yeah, this is a way that we try to kind of bring a little bit more of the news to you and highlight maybe the more noteworthy stuff we've done.
Sounds great. You always do great work, and we always appreciate you taking time, Gabe. Thank you.
All right, thanks for having me, guys.
See you later. Gabe DeArmond of PowerMizzou.com on 101 ESPN. Coming up next in the Fast Lane, we've got a brand new fighter in the Fast Lane in the 4 o'clock fight on 101 ESPN.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of 1. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.